At this time is in the 62nd chapter of Isaiah. This chapter is a continuation of the basic thought that's been given in the last two chapters. It's a consolation to the exiles. It's really talking about God's feeling toward his people and how he is going to act toward them in their time of salvation, in their time of release. And of course, many of these things ultimately do apply to the Christian age, the church age, which is today. Beginning with verse 1, "For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, and the salvation thereof as a lamp that burneth." When he says, "for Zion's sake," this means on account of Zion, because of Zion, or for the well-being of Zion. And, of course, Zion happens to be his people. It would be his people in the time of their return back to Jerusalem. It would be his people even at the time they were still in captivity in Babylon, speaking of them in a figurative sense. And today it is his people, those who are acceptable to God, those who are members of the family of God today, are then regarded as Zion. So, for Zion's sake, will I not hold my peace? Now, the next question we want to ask is, who is I? Who is it that will not hold his peace? For Zion's sake, I will not hold my peace. This is thought to be, among the Bible scholars, usually one of two beings, either Isaiah or God himself. If it is God, then what God is saying is that because of the well-being of Zion, or on account of Zion, I will not hold my peace. That is, I will not cease to work toward the benefit of Zion. If it is Isaiah, then what Isaiah is saying is that the very same thing. I will not cease to prophesy, to speak up for, to stand up for Zion. The reason I'm not holding my peace is for the sake of Zion, for the benefit of Zion. And probably if I had to choose as to which one I referred to, I would probably think it's probably referring to Isaiah. For it seems that this is the language that a prophet would use when he talks about holding his peace rather than God. Isaiah is the one who is giving the words. He is the one who's saying the words. He's the one who is actually doing the prophesying. And so he's working for the benefit of Zion by giving these prophecies, by not holding his peace. So he says, "For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest." Now here again, Jerusalem is another figurative term for the people of God. For Jerusalem's sake. Jerusalem would be the same as Zion. "And for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest." This phrase, "will not rest," means that he will exercise continuous toil. He will continue to labor for the sake of Jerusalem. Then he has the next phrase, "until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness, and the salvation thereof is a lamp that burneth." So he's going to not hold his peace. He is not going to rest until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness. And this word for righteousness means salvation. Till their salvation goes forth as brightness. That is, until their salvation shines forth or illuminates like brightness would illuminate, like brightness goes forth. And the salvation thereof as a lamp that burneth. Here again, the idea of giving forth some kind of light or illumination. So the verse is simply saying that I'm going to work for the benefit of Zion. I'm going to toil for the benefit of Jerusalem, until the salvation thereof, that is the salvation of Jerusalem or the salvation of Zion, go forth as brightness and goes forth as a lamp that burneth. So that the figure here is salvation of Zion will eventually shine like a light. It'll eventually go forth as some sort of a light that would illuminate or burn. Verse 2, and the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness, and all kings thy glory, and thou that shall be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord shall name. So let's look at this phrase, and the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness. Simply a prophecy that the other peoples, namely here Gentiles, would see the righteousness of Zion. See the salvation, see the victory and the success of God's people. The Gentiles would see it. And of course we know that they did more than just see it. They actually joined in the benefit of it. They became a part of Zion themselves. Gentiles are now a part of Zion. Those that are obedient to God. They are a part of the spiritual Jerusalem. Those that are serving the true and living God. In Isaiah 11, verse 10, in that prophecy includes a similar thought to this. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. Simply showing that he's going to stand up an ensign or a banner for the people, something that the people will rally round about, and he says that the Gentiles shall seek to be to it. The Gentiles will seek to come to it, showing that Gentiles then would be drawn by the truth, be drawn by the true and living God, and they would be his followers. They would seek after him, and as he says in this prophecy, in our second verse here, the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness. They're going to see this, and consequently they're going to react to it. And all kings thy glory. Now here again it's a difficult phrase for me to explain what he means by all kings thy glory. But we do know that nation after nation has been allowed to see the triumph of God's people. They have been allowed to benefit as a result of the a people of God simply living according to the things that God has prescribed. Again we quote, and thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord shall name. Simply saying that you're no longer going to be called a people that has been exiled, a land that has been made desolate, a people that have been made to be humiliated and punished because of their sins. But you're going to be called by a new name. And at this point it doesn't say what the new name is, but he does later on in the chapter give some reference to a new name. He says, which the mouth of the Lord shall name. So it's not a name that's going to be given by man. It's not a name that man's going to choose for himself. It's going to be a name that the mouth of the Lord shall name. So it'll come from the Lord. That's what the new name, where it will originate. It'll come from the mouth of the Lord. And this then gives us a lot more feeling and authority for this name, because we know that it's going to come from the mouth of the Lord. Any name that we wear certainly should be something that is appropriate and that we can say has come from the mouth of the Lord. That is any spiritual name. And this also gives us an idea of the fact that it's not up to man to name the things of God and to acquire titles and start calling himself by titles that he does not deserve or have not been authorized for man. We cannot use the titles that belong to God and apply them to man. And one of the most notable examples that comes to my mind is the title of Reverend. Nowhere in the Bible do we have authority from God to call ourselves Reverend. We do know that the Bible teaches that Reverend is his holy name, and so we prefer to let God be the one who is known as Reverend and not have that title or name applied to man. Verse 3, thou shalt also be a crown of glory in the hand of the Lord and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. Now, it seems from this figurative verse that the people of God are going to shine forth with such a bright glory. They're going to be so greatly honored. They're going to have such a favored position in the sight of God that they will be to God like a crown of glory in the hand of the Lord. And there are some who dispute that this should be crowned because they cannot explain why it's in the hand of the Lord, not on the head of the Lord. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a crown in the true sense. It can just be an ornamented object that he's holding, but it certainly could be a crown. But it'll be a crown of glory that he holds in his hand, and you're going to be that crown, which would be a very favored, a very prized object in the eyes of the Lord. And the next phrase, and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. Now, a royal diadem was a wreath or chaplet that was usually set with diamonds, and this was encircled about the head. And it was a crown worn by monarchs. So you'd be like a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. So a crown of glory in his hand and a royal diadem in his hand. And this is a verse that gives us a picture of God then, thinking of his people and acting toward them as though they were a very highly favored and prized object. Verse 4. Thou shalt no more be termed forsaken. Now he just said up there in the second verse that they were going to be given a new name. So he says here that you'll no more be termed or you'll no more be named forsaken. That's not going to be the name that you're going to have anymore after this salvation comes. You're not going to be called forsaken. That'll not be your name. That'll not be the proper way to refer to you. Then he says, neither shall thy land any more be termed desolate. That was a phrase that could have applied to the land that they were taken from. It was a desolate land. People didn't inhabit it anymore. It wasn't a fit place to live because it had been deserted and the people had been taken out of it and all the values had been taken out and the buildings and the city had been sacked. So the land was called or termed desolate, but he says it's not going to be called that anymore. During their captivity, we do not know. Just how much they might have been referred to as the term forsaken and their former country that they had were captured and taken out of was termed desolate or the land of desolation. So here he says, after your salvation has come, after this is over, you're no longer going to be termed forsaken and your land is not going to be termed desolate. But thou shalt be called Hephzibah, and thy land, Beulah. Now this name, Hephzibah, according to the margin of the Hebrew, means my delight is in her, or the object of my delight. You're going to be called my delight. That's what you're going to be called. Now, not anything that's going to be forsaken, not anything that will be a degrading name, but you'll be the delight of the Lord, and thy land, Beulah. And this word Beulah means to be married or inhabited. And it was a common thing to refer to the land or a kingdom being married by the king. Or there was another term then for being inhabited. And this is a figure actually from a married female who had been forsaken, but then who later had their husband to return to them. And was no longer then termed as someone who had been forsaken. So your land will be called Beulah. For the Lord delighteth in thee, and thy land shall be married. So this is the ultimate outcome of your situation with God. The Lord delights in you, and thy land shall be married. That is, your land's going to be inhabited. It's going to be dwelt in. Or dwelt with. Verse 5. For as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee. Now, as a young man marrieth a virgin, is a statement that simply refers to the joys, the pleasures, the utter delight that is found in the pleasure that a young man has when he marries a virgin. That is, when he is living with his wife for the first time. A young man and his new wife are certainly in a state of bliss. It's a social arrangement that brings about great joy that is not found in many other situations. And so he says it's going to be as a young man when he marrieth a virgin. This is the relationship that God's going to have with you. This is the delight, the pleasure, the joyfulness of the occasion. Now the next phrase is a little more difficult to explain or to translate. So shall thy sons marry thee. Now, as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee. Now, there are several ways this can be translated. One translation is, so shall thy sons dwell with thee. So shall thy sons dwell with thee. That is, your offspring are going to continue to stay with you. They'll stay with your religion, your way of life, and they'll not forsake the things that you have taught them. Another translation, though, renders this, so shall thy maker marry thee. And the word here, maker, really means God. So shall thy God marry thee. And the fact that this word sons is in the plural does not alter this any, because many times the word for God is a plural term. So this is probably a translation that does follow the context rather accurately. So shall thy maker marry thee. That is, as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy maker marry thee. God is going to be so closely attached to you that it'll be an attachment that'll be compared to the same one that a young man would have when he marries a virgin. And he goes on and says, and as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. And here again, he just simply describes the great joyful occasion that a bridegroom would have as he rejoices over the bride. He takes pleasure in the bride. So shall thy God rejoice over thee. Showing these people that they would no longer really be in a forsaken condition. That God did have a very close feeling for them, and at a future time he would have a very close relationship with them. A relationship that can be compared to a young man marrying a virgin and to a bridegroom rejoicing over the bride. So shall thy God rejoice over thee. Now in verse 6, he further states his attention to this people. He says, I have set watchmen upon thy walls over O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace, day nor night. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence. I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem. Now this is a statement that is an allusion to the watchmen who guarded the cities in that part of the world. And I understand that even down to recent times, this practice has still been continued. The watchmen would make the rounds on the walls of the cities, and they would cry forth every hour or at a certain designated time to let it be known that all was well. Also to let it be known that they were awake and still watching. And a part of their cry would include the fact that they would make mention of the Lord. Well, the watchman that he's talking about in this particular passage would be the ones who are responsible for overseeing the affairs and duties of the people of God. They, during the Old Testament dispensation, would be the priests. those who are responsible for teaching the people, the prophets. In the New Testament dispensation, they would simply be the members of the church. They are the ones who are watching after the things of Jerusalem, the things of Zion. They're the ones who would be considered to be the watchmen upon the walls. Now he says, I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace, day nor night. Now this was going to be a group of watchmen that would continually be watching and would never hold their peace. They would never stop declaring the call of having kept the watch. So you could see that Jerusalem would be well guarded, well protected, well watched over. Never hold their peace day nor night. As this relates then to God's ministers, we're talking about the priests and the prophets, they would have to be most attentive in the things of God. They would never relent in their unceasing effort to continue to teach and to follow after the things of God and to show others the true way of God. As it relates to the church, then those in the church never cease to watch. They never hold their peace, day nor night. There's never a time when the church can be said to truly be silenced, but it will continually, forever be endeavoring to teach, to proclaim, to spread the true word of God. In Isaiah 56, when he was describing the watchmen who were not doing the will of God, Isaiah 56 and 10, he says, his watchmen are blind, they are all ignorant, they are all dumb dogs, they cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. Now this is his description of the ministers of God that were not doing God's will. They were described as dumb dogs that cannot bark. They were blind, they were ignorant, they were sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. Now the opposite of that is his description in this verse, in verse 6, I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day nor night. These were not lazy dogs, dumb dogs that were lying down and loving to slumber. These were watchmen that would never hold their peace day nor night. Then he has a colon after that, which means there's going to be a further explanation now of them or of their duty. He says, ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence. Now these are the watchmen he's talking about. And the duties of these watchmen, the function, the acts of these watchmen, are to make mention of the Lord. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence. This word make mention, or phrase make mention, means to bring to remembrance. Ye that bring to remembrance the Lord. Now it doesn't mean that they were bringing anything to God's remembrance, but it means that they were bringing the Lord to remembrance to those round about them. They were causing those around them to remember the Lord. Ye that bring to remembrance the Lord, keep not silence. Now to me this is a very important phrase because it gives us a great insight as to exactly what God's watchmen are to do. Their function is to bring to remembrance the Lord. They are to cause people to remember the Lord. And they are to bring to their remembrance the things that they might have already heard, they might have already studied about, but they are to bring these things to their remembrance continually. He says, keep not silence. Keep on bringing to remembrance. Now this reminds me of a scripture in 2 Peter 1, verses 13 through 15, in which Peter said a thought very similar to this. He says, yea, I think it meet, as long as I am in this tabernacle, to stir you up by putting you in remembrance. That was one of the functions that Peter had, and one of the things he thought was very appropriate was to put these people in remembrance, and consequently this would stir them up. knowing that shortly I must put off this my tabernacle, even as our Lord Jesus Christ hath showed me. Moreover, I will endeavor that ye may be able, after my decease, to have these things always in remembrance." So one of the most important things here that Peter says is that he wanted the people to be able to have these things always in remembrance. And one of his functions was to stir them up by putting them in remembrance. To stir you up by putting you in remembrance. Now, the point I want to make here is that our duty today, our function today as watchmen upon the walls of Jerusalem, is to bring to remembrance, to stir up by bringing to remembrance the Lord. And this teaches me very plainly that we do not teach anything that's new. We do not receive any new and miraculous prophecy. Our purpose is simply to reflect, is simply to bring to remembrance the things that have already been taught. That's the function of the watchmen upon the walls. That's the thing they are to do when they keep not silence. That's the thing that'll happen when they never hold their peace day nor night. They will bring to remembrance the Lord. And I think if we could see this and truly understand that that is our function, rather than to get up and to make some kind of a speech, to make some kind of a talk that nobody else has ever made, to arrange things in such a way that we have made a unique speech, that we would see better how to teach God's will and God's word. God does not want us to make a speech. He does not want us to teach some kind of a lesson or a sermon that's never been taught. We have so many great and beautiful and miraculously inspired lessons in the Bible that if we can simply reflect these, if we can teach these like they have already been given and simply bring to remembrance here things that have already been taught, then we have fully served our function as watchmen, and we have done a better job of it than those who would make the good words and fair speeches which do deceive the hearts of the simple. Now, there's hardly any religion in the land that does not have ministers that'll get up and give good words and fair speeches. But it's very rare to find those who teach the Bible simply as it's written. They take it verse by verse. They take it phrase by phrase. And all they're simply doing is to reflect and to bring to remembrance the things that are already there. You know, when you teach that way, a person can open the Bible after you've finished, and they can read along the passage that you've been teaching from, and they can follow your lesson. They have a good outline of it. They know exactly what the source of it is, because there it's all laid out word for word in the Bible, and in the proper sequence and in the proper context. And so this is the thing we're to do. We're simply to bring to remembrance the Lord, or make mention of the Lord. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence. And we do it day and night. Verse 7, "And give him no rest till he establisheth, and till he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth." Now, to give him no rest would simply imply that you will pray, you will implore, you will approach him continuously. Give him no rest till he establish and till he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth. This would be then for God to bring about the salvation of his people, to make this place, which can be literal at some times and spiritual and figurative at other times, to make this place known as Jerusalem a praise in the earth. Not a desolate place, not a forsaken place, but a place now that has the temple of God, in which God's people reside, and which the service of God is carried out. Verse 8, "The Lord has sworn by his right hand, and by the arm of his strength,